All right, guys, welcome to Deborah Gets Red Pilled, episode 44. It's Sunday, Easter Sunday, April 4th, 2021. I'm coming at you from the Chicken Room in Milwaukee, Oregon. Slightly overcast today, but moderate temperature. It's a good one. I've been outside mowing the lawn, running the weed whacker a little bit to get the parts I can't get with the lawnmower. Deborah's late, so we're waiting on her. Our guest is in the waiting room. We're going to buzz him in a little bit. Yeah, guys, we got a good schedule coming up. We got a lot of good shit. I got all of April booked, half of May booked, and maybe I was really optimistic about the intro I did with Deborah yesterday, and seems like we're able to riff off each other pretty good. And Deborah's here. Let's buzz her in. So hopefully we're going to be able to do some solo episodes maybe in May. So if there's any questions you want me to ask her, we got to start holding her feet to the fire, because she's just agreeing, saying, oh yeah, that's too bad. You know, I want to hear what she thinks is going to happen about stuff. And I know you guys too, because she's disagreeing with stuff. And she's agreeing with me on a lot of things, disagreeing on a lot of what's going on in the world, but not really taking a stand. And are you there?
I'm here.
Okay. I started at 12:15. It's 12:17. So we've been going for 2 minutes. How's it going?
It's going well. How's it going with you?
I'm sorry. What was that?
How's it going with you?
It's going good. What are you doing for Easter? Celebrating the death of Jesus?
This is what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Right here, right now.
Do you feel any responsibility for his death?
No, I don't.
Okay, got it.
Do you feel any responsibility for his death?
No, I'm a Christian.
Okay.
I mowed the lawn and didn't do much. Made some eggs. Didn't go on an egg hunt or anything. I'll have eggs in the chicken coop later, so that'll be my egg hunt for the day. They're really, really producing a lot. Some days we get more eggs than there's chickens in there.
That's crazy, huh?
So like we're backed up. We have like over 60 eggs right now. Emily might start trying to sell them at her new place of business. So we got our guest in the waiting room, but let's get some business out of the way. We had a pretty good intro yesterday, didn't you think?
Yeah.
I felt like we were able to flow pretty well. And so I have all of April booked, but in May we've got some stuff booked, and then maybe we could go back and do some solo episodes.
Okay.
So why don't you start making a list of stuff that you want to talk about, stuff that you're interested in, mostly political stuff that we can just bounce off each other. And, we'll figure it out. I think people really like when it's just the two of us on our intros. I know I do. I go back and I used to listen to every episode. I used to go back and listen to the whole thing. Now I mostly just listen to the intros and see how it went. And, you know, you can go back and be like, oh man, I could have driven that point home better if I did this. And you always think that. So
I guess
got a couple emails to report on. I think Chris from Beaverton sent me an email, and he really liked our intro yesterday. He pointed out kind of what I disagreed with Micah on about how flat earthers are, you know, get really angry and yell and stuff, where I thought that it goes the other way. I think flat earthers are so used to being disagreed with that they're able to kind of like keep their cool. And I think that ends up pissing people off more.
Yeah. I have to agree with that. I am not a flat earther. However, I see that the reaction from people who I talk about it with, they get very upset.
Yeah.
It's very threatening.
Yeah. It's weird. It doesn't threaten me at all.
Mm-hmm.
I'm right about the Ronnie James Dio instead of Kiss coming up with the horns.
Uh-huh.
He was the first one to do it. And I had somebody on Twitter hit me up and tell me that I was correct on that as well. So guys, we are value for value. Hold on. I got an interesting text right now. Oh, somebody wants to maybe buy my motorcycle, but he's kind of being shady about it. So
Same guy
said he's going to come on Saturday, talk my ear off for 20 minutes, and then never texted me about it. Like, he asked me to send him pictures and videos of it. I'd like, it says right in the Craigslist ad, it's not perfect. You know, it's got some scratches and scrapes. It was fucking ridden. You know, I rode the shit out of that thing. I sent him some pictures of like the scrapes on the exhaust pipe and like on the fairing. And he's like, oh, geez, sure looks like it needs some love. I'm like, yeah, that's why I told you that. It says it right in the ad, you know, like, so, but yeah, he can wait. But we got, so we're value for value, guys. We are relying on your donations. I just got a donation from Cody Hoffman, who has been a consistent donator to the show. We got another one from Anthony. So those two guys are really, really helping us out a lot. So thank you guys so much.
Thank
we really appreciate
both.
It. And guys, send us some value that you're getting out of the show. We really appreciate it. And send us some crypto. We want crypto. We want Ravencoin. We want Bitcoin. We want Ethereum. We want Doge. We want everything. And we want to know all the weird little ones that you're getting involved with too. So hopefully the crypto episode. Oh yeah, we want Ravencoin. We want everybody who listened to the crypto episode to get involved and take advantage of this time right now and take control of your financial destiny. Do not leave it in the hands of the big banks, because at some point, you never know what's going to happen. If the big banks just decided to keep your money, you have no recourse. So that's pretty much, that's the business, guys. Send us emails. We want to know who you want to have on.
Yeah, what you want to hear.
I want to have on somebody that can kind of what you weren't grasping yesterday, what I was having a hard time trying to explain to you about the whole church of woke thing, you know, how kind of the social justice movement has paralleled Orthodox religion, you know, like it's become the new form of a religion. Does that make sense?
No, I the whole thing is kind of I'm having a hard time making the connection.
What's the block?
That people would get the same kind of comfort, support, whatever it is from the state that they get. And I am not a religious person.
I'm not saying from the state. I'm saying the state is involved in it, but the whole like the whole organization of people joining together for social justice is equivalent to people joining together as a religion. They have all the same tenets. They have original sin, which is being born white. They have, you know, excommunication, which is being canceled. They have...
I didn't hear that yesterday. What I heard was more of a... really the state, the union, that was where people were turning.
But under all that, God is the state. God is the all-powerful, the one that's the one that is going to take care of you. There's no more mutual aid. Whereas back in the day before there was all these government programs, people would join band together and be like, oh, Bob and Sally are having a hard time. They got four kids. Bob got laid off at the mill. So, you know, the local Methodist church is going to get together, pull some money, give them food and make sure they get through the hard time until Bob can pick up some work, you know, like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all gone. And I feel like religion, whatever your opinion is on it, I think it was kind of worked out of our culture in the 80s and 90s, whereas before it was pretty strong. And like up till now, where like there's barely anybody, you know, that's religious anymore. There are a lot of places in the country, but where we are, not very much, right?
Right.
And it's strange, there's way more religious people around me than there are in California. So I want to get somebody on, like, that's what my problem is that I get, you know, I'm so steeped in this and it just like makes perfect sense to me. And it's, I'm like, oh, why isn't it making perfect sense to you?
Why doesn't she get it? Yeah.
Yeah. But I'm admitting I'm really bad at explaining stuff. Like I have so much stuff jumbled up in my brain that I can't really get it out sometimes, you know? So that's a weak point for me, but it helps if I can just ask you basic questions. And like what we did yesterday with the whole thing about racism of low expectations, it made you think of something in a different
light. Totally opened that up. Yeah.
Yeah.
So gratitude to you.
Yeah. But yeah, the one thing that I noticed when you guys were here last week was that I think there's two different kinds of compliance. There's a kind of compliance that people are giving over because they're genuinely terrified. And I saw that from half the people that were with you.
Mm-hmm.
And the other kind that I see is people that, and I think the people that are genuinely terrified can be reached. And the other half is, I think, people that are being compliant because they're part of the whole church of woke and it's what's expected. And if you don't go along with the compliance, you can get excommunicated,
ostracized,
or canceled. Yeah. And so does that, I'm not going to get into anything specific based because of privacy stuff. And, you know, nobody asked us to talk about it or gave us permission to, but do you see what I mean? Like the whole thing where you're,
I do.
Where at sometimes you're not allowed to see your friends because of something you did wrong. So like having to go quarantine because you saw people who weren't wearing masks, like, And it's just so crazy because nobody in my life is like that, you know? And if somebody said, oh, you were out with people who are non-believers, you have to go sit by yourself for 3 weeks. Like I'd say, fuck you. You're not my real friend, you know? But I do. I mean, most of my friends are people from my past that aren't falling for it. Conspiracy people and jujitsu people. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I go do, you know, if you do jujitsu, you can't really be concerned with germs. But one of the people that was with you was eating sushi communally with me on his last night here. And I feel like he might have made a few steps in the right direction on his trip. Because if you're eating out of the same bowl of cucumber salad with somebody with chopsticks, that doesn't seem like you're that scared of germs.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really good to see. I think I did a good job of keeping my mouth shut with everybody here. And I think I kind of tried to lead by, you know, as they say, attraction rather than promotion. So hopefully I made a little difference and I didn't, you know, yell and scream at people and people can see like, oh, Adam's not a crazy QAnon psycho. So with that being said, sorry, I've just been talking a whole bunch, guys. I need to let Deborah talk a little more. Let's pause and our guests here and we'll be right back. All right, guys, we're back and we're here with our new friend and our guest for the day. You know him from his show Slow News Day. He's a member of the Union of the Unwanted. He's been on Macroaggressions and multiple other podcasts that we like. It's going to be Steve Poikkanen from Slow News Day. How's it going, man?
It's going really well, man. I'm stoked to be here. I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah, we're really happy to have you here. We haven't gotten into what we're going to get into today, and it's mostly going to be the case of Julian Assange and what's going on with him, what's happened to him, and what's going on with it in the future. And you know, it's a pretty sad story. I'd like to hear your thoughts on it. I know you're a big activist in the community for it. And if we can convince Deborah for one more reason why Barack Obama was a horrible person in the conversation, you know, that'd be cool too.
I'm always fascinated to hear what people have to say about Julian Assange or about WikiLeaks. So Deborah, if you like, just whatever you got, you know, do you know anything at all about WikiLeaks as an organization or Julian Assange in general, or where are we at here?
Yeah. I know a little bit. I know probably just what the mainstream news says, that, you know, he's been, he was in the Ecuadorian, what do you call it?
Embassy.
Thank you.
Yeah.
For 7 years?
Seven and a half years, yeah.
Which, wow. And then they wanted to extradite him to Sweden on some rape charges that got dropped and then picked up again. And so he was in prison because he didn't comply with some bail thing. And that's where he continues to be now.
But do you know what he was in trouble for and why he had to be in the Ecuadorian embassy in the first place?
All the leaks, the correspondence and whatnot about Afghanistan and the helicopters, the U.S. helicopter shooting at people. And
that's called collateral murder, that video. And tomorrow, as a matter of fact, is the 11th anniversary of its release. That was footage of a U.S. Army Apache helicopter massacring 16 unarmed civilians and children. And there's like video game kind of commentary from the soldiers as they're, you know, just releasing hundreds of rounds of machine gun fire from the sky at a van that is trying to transport dead and wounded people away, who again, unarmed. The fascinating thing about that is that 11 years down the road, the only two people that have seen the inside of a jail cell because of that documented war crime are the whistleblower who gave the footage to Julian Assange and Julian Assange. You couldn't have it more or better documented. You know, that this was taking place. And if you talk to one of the gentlemen who was in the helicopter, has gone on to like speak about this and has become kind of an anti-war activist in his own right. and points out, you know, to the extreme, like the real crime being that no one but the whistleblower and the publisher have faced any jail time for this. So Julian Assange he sought asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy because he was a target of multiple world governments. There were hacked emails that came out from a company called HB Gary. I don't know if they're 2010, right around Thanksgiving. Anonymous announced, you know, the hacktivist collective, Guy Fawkes masks.
Yeah. You know about Anonymous, Deborah?
Yeah.
They hacked a ton of companies, released all of these emails, and part of it was a corporate espionage outfit giving their plan for Julian Assange. And there's, you know, an email of this that says, you know, keep him tied up in the legal system for 25 years, move him from court to court, go after his family, set him up with hookers, just whatever we can throw at this guy to get him off the board. And, you know, 11, 12 years later from the release of that email, that's pretty much exactly where we're at. The Swedish thing is really, I would love to actually send you guys this article. The UN special rapporteur on torture, a guy named Nils Melzer, whose job it is to investigate, you know, claims of torture and human rights abuses, gave an interview with a Czech magazine called The Republic. And it's his story where he had believed the mainstream narratives about Julian Assange 100% and thought, well, if the guy's in prison and has been like, doing this for this long, obviously some of the stuff that they've said about him is true. And he wouldn't look into it. For 2 years, the legal team kept hounding him. He finally looked into the case. He took two doctors with him to Belmarsh prison, where Julian to this day it is. And we'll get to that in a moment. And they had found, they examined him and they spent a lot of time with him. They found that he exhibited all of the signs of prolonged psychological torture and was starting to show signs of physical torture. Solitary confinement by the Geneva Convention is a form of torture. The UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention had found that his time in the embassy, the 7.5 years, was arbitrary detention because he literally could not leave. If he stepped foot outside the embassy, he was liable to be black bagged and taken to a CIA black site. And everyone knew that. In fact, Julian Assange and his lawyers multiple times over those 7.5 years reached out to Swedish officials because they knew that the charges alleging sexual assault were made up. And that's something that comes out through documents in the article with the UN torture rapporteur, who speaks fluent Swedish. So he was able to read the emails and be like, oh my God, they've been setting him up for a decade. And that's one of the conclusions that he comes to in the article. It's called A Murderous System is Being Created Before Our Eyes. Fascinating. And you couldn't pick a more, you know, credentialed and respected individual than the United Nations Rapporteur on Torture for this kind of thing. So it is helpful with us in the activism. I'm all over the place right here because it's been such a wild story. I mean, it sounds like it's out of a spy novel. If you have any questions at this point, Deborah, please ask, and I'm happy to try and address them.
Why was Chelsea Manning was released early?
No.
Oh, okay.
No. So in the court martial, sentenced to, let's see. Well, I guess early, yes, because her sentence was commuted by Barack Obama on his way out the door. I think she was sentenced to 35 years. And
for leaking the footage of the helicopter attack.
Yes. Yeah. She okay. was. Yeah. Yeah. Courtman and tried under the Espionage Act. And it wasn't actually the helicopter attack never came into play because they threw it out in the court martial because it disclosed U.S. Army rules of engagement. So they couldn't, for national security reasons, allow footage of a war crime in their courtroom. It was for the Afghan war files, the war logs, the Iraq war logs. Cablegate, which was the diplomatic cable releases that happened over a number of months in 2011 and 2012, largest single release of diplomatic cables, low level, you know, but like minorly classified, But Hillary Clinton was furious, that declared war on Julian Assange, said out loud that she wanted him extrajudicially assassinated. So it was those, and the Guantanamo Bay files, which disclosed the specific torture methods used at Guantanamo Bay. And they had already been saying, no, we don't do this. This isn't anything we do. Obama had already come out and been like, we tortured some folks. Yeah, and that was bad. You know, and that had already happened. And then the Gitmo manual comes out and it's like, oh, they're still doing it. And it's used as a way to score political points with the U.S., saying this person is a terrorist. Oh, and there's a 14-year-old here. I didn't know that. A 14-year-old kid in Guantanamo Bay who's being tortured every day. Did not know that. They have an 89-year-old man here. Why do they have an 89-year-old man in Guantanamo Bay? And this is just stuff that we learned that we never would have had access to without Julian Assange, WikiLeaks, Chelsea Manning. So yeah, her sentence was commuted. Funny thing about commutation. Commutation doesn't mean everything's dropped. It means the door is open to prosecute again, which happened to Chelsea Manning. She was reincarcerated, let out, and then reincarcerated.
Wasn't she put back in prison for refusing to testify?
Yeah, and she has one of the best statements on refusal to participate in the grand jury process ever written. It's phenomenal. Like the way that she, and not just the fact that the WikiLeaks grand jury, which is what they were trying to get her to testify for, not just the WikiLeaks grand jury, but all grand juries. She's got a wonderful statement about that. So she wouldn't testify for them. She maintained that they already had her testimony. They had her testimony from her court martial. It's already on record. She was not going to say anything more. She was not going to lie to the grand jury, and she was not going to give them what they wanted. They already had her words. Those are her words. And so they, the written into U.S. law is, if the judge in the case believes that more jail time and more fines will break the individual and they will testify, he's allowed to keep levying those. As soon as the judge is determined that the punishment won't break the person, then he has to let them out. At no point did Judge Anthony Tringa come to the conclusion that heaping more time or more fines on Chelsea Manning was going to going to break. He didn't come to that conclusion. He thought we could keep doing it, even though she had said a number of times, I don't care how long you give me or how much you charge me, I'm not going to change my story. So they were deliberately torturing her. She tried to kill herself in the Alexandria Detention Center. I was in front of that building last year in February. We went out and protested in front of it. And then like 2 weeks later, they dismissed the WikiLeaks grand jury. And so she was let out, and another guy named Jeremy Hammond was also let out, or let back to Oklahoma State Prison, where he finished his sentence for participation in some high profile hacks going back to 2010. Sorry. But yeah, so. Really long answer, Deborah, and I'm sorry about that. But so, yeah. Yes, kind of. Her sentence was reduced, but it wasn't. She wasn't pardoned. Yeah, there with a presidential pardon, like, you can't reopen the case and you can't be tried for it from another angle. With a presidential commutation, all that means is you're out of jail now, but the door is still open for further prosecution.
So there's no end in sight for her at this stage of the game.
They could theoretically, because the grand jury has been dismissed, so they could impanel a new grand jury and then call her to testify, and she would refuse, and then they would lock her up again. But the odds of that happening are pretty slim, because we're now into an appeal process in this extradition. So last year, And you guys touched on this a little bit. I guess, well, January 4th of this year, extradition was denied. It was denied on the grounds that U.S. prisons are awful. just awful. And that Julian Assange is smart enough and determined enough to take his own life if he was extradited there. So on those grounds only, he was the extradition was denied. The judge agreed with all of the legal arguments to the case, which are essentially fan fiction written by a State Department sci-fi enthusiast and Robert Ludlum fanboy, because none of it is based in reality. And most of it is taken from a book that has been debunked by two journalists, Luke Harding and David Lee from The Guardian. This is also the same book where they gave away the second part of a password that had all of the unredacted versions of those diplomatic cables that we were talking about, that Julian Assange eventually got blamed for and smeared for. But it was these two journalists in their book who released this passport. That's a third of the U.S. prosecution's case. A third of it is testimony from an Icelandic one-time employee of WikiLeaks who was put there by the FBI, paid by the FBI the entire time he was working at WikiLeaks, went to prison for embezzling from WikiLeaks for pretending to be Julian Assange. While in prison, they found out that he was also a serial pedophile and has been convicted or has been certified as a sociopath. This is the United States prosecution's first star witness. Their second is the paid informant that they had orchestrate a number of high profile hacks. A guy whose name is Hector Monsegur, he goes by Sabu, or that was his online handle. so that's a third of their testimony is from two paid FBI essentially employees who went in to disrupt and to cause trouble. And then a third of their testimony is from a couple of expert witnesses about prison conditions and Julian Assange's mental health, neither of whom had either been inside an American U.S. prison or had interviewed Julian Assange about his mental health.
So he's in Sweden right now.
No, he is in Belmarsh prison in the United Kingdom. The Swedish thing is a red herring.
Okay.
It was one of the like honey trap kind of things that they were trying to set him up with. Charges in that were never filed. They were never meant to be filed. There was supposed to be an investigation that got opened, which happened. And then there was no evidence for it, so they dismissed it. And then they reopened it because the UK was putting huge pressure on them to do so. Hey, you've got to reopen this case. We need to find a reason to get him and get him here, you know. So they reopened the case, but again, never brought charges. Just they was in this legal limbo.
Was it meant to convict him in the court of public opinion, or just to muck up the whole system?
Yeah, no. If you never actually file charges, then the public never knows that it was a made up investigation.
Because I know right? What they like. It's like what they did with Ross Ulbricht when they charged him with those that he said he was going to pay people to kill people, but he never got charged with it. But he was already. If you ask like a normal person about it that doesn't know anything about the case, they'll say like, oh, well, he deserves what he got because he's trying to kill people.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I mean, we have people scream at us when we hold these events. He's a rapist. It's a really heavy allegation to lay on anyone. Could you please show me proof of that?
Yeah.
Well, I can't. Okay, can you show me that there was ever a charge filed? Well, no, I can't. Then why are you calling this man a rapist? Because the news said, now we're on to something.
Yeah.
Now we're going somewhere. You know, now we can have a conversation about this.
So he's in England. And so what's the situation looking like now?
So since September of 2019, because Deborah, you had mentioned like a bail charge, and that was something. There was a week after he was given asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy, the UK officials set a bench warrant for him so that he could testify over the Swedish investigation. They wanted him to leave the embassy and go to UK Metro Police. He would not do that because UK Metro Police would give him no guarantee that he wouldn't be black bagged and thrown to a CIA black site.
Yeah, because once he leaves the embassy, is fair game.
And he said, well, you can come here and you can see me in the embassy and I'm happy to give an interview. I'm happy to, and it doesn't, you know, any time of day I'm here for that. And they instead issued a warrant and set bail for him, so that when they finally dragged him out, they could charge him with a bail violation. They gave him 50 weeks for violating bail, which was the longest sentence for that in the modern era of UK criminal justice. And since then, he has been in what they call the Guantanamo Bay of the United Kingdom, Belmarsh Prison. It's where all of their like, yeah, the worst of the worst go, and all of their terrorist suspects and all of that kind. That's where he's at. Again, not charged with any violent crime, you know, charged with being a publisher of a website, locked up with murderers. He's been without charges. So he's been a political prisoner exclusively since September of 2019.
And what reason did they give for putting him into... my brain's not working.
Solitary confinement.
Thank you.
He's the United States was seeking to extradite him under the Espionage Act, so they were treating him like a spy, essentially, like basically like a secret agent. So like he's super dangerous, so they can't let him around anyone, because at any moment he could, I don't know, like steal a phone and hack the planet or something. I mean, just this is how ridiculous it is, though. But what it really comes down to is that the United States is seeking international jurisdiction over the press. Julian Assange is an Australian citizen with a business registered in Iceland, who has never set foot in the United States of America. Not once in his life has he ever touched down on U.S. soil. But the United States is seeking to extradite him under our Espionage Act and the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which is a law that got passed in, I think, 82 or 84. After Congress saw the movie War Games and got so scared, they wrote legislation about it. That's a true story.
That's Matthew Broderick, right?
Yeah.
Good movie.
War Games. Yeah. Yeah. So Congress watched it. Congress watched it and got so scared, they passed these like ridiculous laws that now are being used to criminalize source protection in journalism. Is what they're essentially, and so they're saying that Julian Assange, because it's saying that Julian Assange had a conversation with Chelsea Manning about how to conceal her identity when she went into the system to go find the material that became the war logs and Cablegate and collateral murder. That's what journalists do every day, every single day. Every journalist on the planet has said, I would like for you to be my source and I would like you to not get caught. Here's, to the best of my ability, advice I can give you on how to do that. So if journalists can't protect their sources, there is no journalism. There's certainly no investigative journalism.
Deborah's favorite journalist is Don Lemon. Does he do that?
Would Don Lemon cultivate a source? Absolutely. Would Don Lemon tell a source to cover their tracks? Absolutely. That is basic, just an entry level journalism. Yeah, 100%.
So who initiated the contact? Was it Julian or Chelsea?
No, Chelsea Manning had when so to make it even more ridiculous, Chelsea Manning didn't even need a username or a password to access all of the Iraq war logs, Cablegate, and collateral murder. Everyone at her grade had access to that computer, didn't even have to sign in.
How far up was she?
She was incredibly low level.
Is it like a GS level or something?
Yeah, entry level data analyst.
Like GS, do you know what number?
No, I do not off the top of my head. And I should, and I'm sorry, I don't.
That's okay.
I mean, she was
just entry level computer monkey.
Like, yeah. Low level analyst.
She at the time was I don't want to dead name anybody, but it was Bradley.
Yeah.
And they were enlisted in the army.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. Yeah. Enlisted army data analyst. There were over 100,000 people in the U.S. Army at her rank that had access to all of the material that she gave to Julian Assange. But first, she tried the New York Times. She tried the Washington Post. She tried Politico. And it was only after like 3 months of them going, no, we're not going to print that, that she went to Julian Assange and he went, it's going to take a minute to verify, but yeah, the requirements to publish on WikiLeaks are, it's got to be new. Okay. It can't have been published anywhere else. It has to be vetted. And it has to be vetted because you're not good. WikiLeaks is the only outlet to this day that has a 100% accuracy rating. It's never had to issue a retraction. It's never had to issue an apology. It's never had to pull anything. There is not another major news outlet on the planet that can say that.
Did any of the other outlets that she tried to give the information to, did any of them ever blow the whistle on her, squeal on her, or did any of them keep their mouth shut and then face disciplinary actions or anything?
So it was a guy, a blogger named Adrian Lamo, who ratted out Chelsea Manning. But he wasn't attached to he wasn't part of the team that worked with WikiLeaks for the New York Times on the release of the war logs or collateral murder.
How did he know about the Wiki drops?
Because she was talking to him in a chat room.
Okay.
He was a blogger for Wired or something like that. And so I think his handle at the time was like Bradass or something like that. But like got into a conversation with Adrian Lamo about it because they're initially kind of wanted to brag. Like, if you're responsible for the largest release of information ever about your country's military, exposes everything that's wrong with it, and from the perspective of I signed up to go serve my country, this is what my country has done with my time and my service, I don't want to destroy the country, I want to get rid of the bad things that we have done so that if we're going to do things, they can be good things. Little bit of naive mentality, but like, it wasn't out of malice, it was out of this has to be exposed if we're going to make it better. And so that guy immediately, while they're having like day two of conversation, and Chelsea Manning is like pouring out how emotionally unstable and scared the dude's on the phone with the FBI. And then she got, tortured for a straight year in Fallujah before they brought her to the U.S.
Yeah.
By the army.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
and just real quick, all of this is happening 2010
Okay, that's what I was just going to ask. And on. Yeah. And who, Deborah, who was the in the Oval Office 2010?
Barack Obama.
And what had he said in his lead up to becoming president? What had he included in kind of his campaign platform bullet points?
I don't recall. I don't know what you're...
Do you know, Steve, what I'm getting at?
That the Obama White House would be the most transparent White House in history. Was that?
And what were they going to do for whistleblowers?
Oh, protect and strengthen the protections that exist.
And then when did that change? Was this what changed him? Did they redact that from the campaign platform, or were they elected on it and then... And then this
happened. No, they were elected on that. People had a genuine feeling. I legitimately remember this in 2009. People had a legitimate feeling that they were going to get transparency and accountability out of the White House. That was all of the marketing. That's what, you know, that was the narrative that was coming forward, is that this was going to be different. The last guys were criminals, obviously. George Bush, monster. I maintain to this day that, like, George Bush W. Bush, one of the worst leaders in history, period.
At least of our lifetime. I don't know how old you are. I'm probably about the same as you.
I'm 43.
I'm 41. So I know you got maybe a little more Carter than I did. I think George W. Bush is the worst of our lifetime. And I think he's, you know, making a strong run at Woodrow Wilson, but that's a whole different talk.
Yeah.
His dad wasn't the greatest either. Go ahead.
Oh, I was gonna say, what I have noticed though, H.W. Bush, far worse than W. Bush. It's just
as a human being.
Well, most people don't look at Reagan's 8 years as H.W. Bush's.
Yeah, George Herbert Walker Bush's reign of terror went from, you know, the 40s until, you know,
George H.W. Bush literally walked out of the door of the director's office of the CIA into the White House as vice president.
Yeah.
And since then, we have had unfettered national security state control of every aspect of our government. And each president has become successively more subservient to Reagan's brand of neoliberal terror, I guess, is what it would amount to. But it's a succession of that ideology compounded.
Yeah.
And there's no real, like, there are some wedge issues and there are some things that garner, like, social points.
Like the abortion talk or something that.
But the big ticket items, the forever war, the surveillance, the invading countries for the extraction of their natural resources, and the clampdown on basic civil and human rights and liberties, like that, there's no political ideology there. It's just that's what power does.
Yeah, that's like it's like Barack Obama's George W. Bush, but you can get an abortion.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, do you look, the Hellfire missiles have a rainbow flag painted on them now.
Yeah,
everybody's happy.
Yeah, yeah.
Jesus.
It's like the person ordering these drone strikes is a lesbian BIPOC general in the army. You know,
yeah, that I mean, makes it much better. Joe Biden quite literally plucked Raytheon's, you know, CEO and put him in secretary as Secretary of Defense, but because he's a black man, it's historic.
Do you know what Raytheon is, Deborah?
They have a lot of big government contracts.
For what?
I'm assuming, like, war. I don't know.
Yeah, Raytheon's a defense contractor.
They're CEO is what you said is now what's his position?
The Secretary of Defense.
But he's a black guy, so it's okay.
Yes.
How do you feel, Deborah?
Sick.
um the woman who's at the who's now the director of national intelligence was a consultant for Palantir and like was a cheerleader of Gina Haspel's and
who,
then
now who are those names?
Palantir is a software company that is honestly one of the more nefarious business entities on the planet. Peter Thiel is one of the people who founded it. Peter Thiel also started PayPal with Elon Musk and a guy named Pierre Omidyar, who is a billionaire financier and also owns The Intercept. So those three guys started PayPal. But Palantir does, they're the company that makes the software for ICE. So that when like ICE wants to go do a raid, that's Palantir's software that's helping them, you know, target and recognize individuals. Palantir has also been awarded contracts to digitize and kind of hold and monitor the data for all of our healthcare and all of the healthcare in the United Kingdom and all of the healthcare in Australia and all of the healthcare in New Zealand. Yeah. And they're a U.S. defense contractor.
Wow.
With all of our healthcare information.
I wonder if they're going to have anything to do with these new COVID passports. What do you think, Deborah?
I think you can see the writing on the wall.
Interestingly enough, man, Peter Thiel was one of Donald Trump's biggest donors and supporters right up until he got the healthcare contracts in four different countries. And then he dropped Trump like a bad penny and walked away. Yeah,
it's
like Trump had him on boards and stuff. It like couldn't parade him around enough. That's my buddy.
Peter Thiel's the one that's getting like young people's blood pumped into him, right?
He's one of those guys. Yeah.
Yeah, that's
yeah, he's
nuts.
One of those guys. But there's a whole like,
that's for real, Deborah. He gets like blood transfusions from like young. I don't know if anybody here ever watched the show Silicon Valley, but there's like a Peter Thiel imitation character on it. Yeah, and they show it on the show.
And if you ask Peter Thiel about it, he's like, "Oh, I get. Yeah, it's the Keith Richards."
Yeah, yeah.
Because Keith Richards would get regular blood transfusions from like, you know, teenagers or 20-year-olds just so he would no longer have all of the drugs in his bloodstream. And that's like the concept here is that like if you're taking the actual blood from a younger person and putting it into your veins, that it may give you some more longevity or it may, you know, what I've come to figure out, Deborah, is that it doesn't matter if I believe it. It matters if they believe it, because if they believe it, they're going to do it.
Yeah. All right. So we got in deep. What is your organization and what are you guys doing these days to promote the cause?
So I have an organization called Action for Assange. We, for the last 92 weeks, twice a week, we've been holding like online vigils where we'll have people who are independent journalists or whistleblowers themselves, or, you know, were part of that national security apparatus and have retired and then have come forward with a completely different line of information than what they were giving while they were employed by the U.S. government. And people connected to WikiLeaks and in that sphere. And through that, like, we built a pretty wonderful community of activists and people who are, you know, becoming aware about what's happening with an increased national security state and the attacks to free press and the First Amendment and everything that stems from that. So we started holding events last year, this week, or this coming weekend, I guess, next Sunday, Saturday and Sunday, we called for an international day of action around the 2-year anniversary of Julian being violently and illegally dragged out of Belmarsh prison. That was the other thing. He had Ecuadorian citizenship. It was revoked without due process by a client president of the U.S. So internationally now we've got over 26 cities that are participating in these events. We're going to hold a press panel. I'm going to Los Angeles because I live in California. And it's the first time that I haven't had to go to Washington, D.C. for one of these. I'm pretty stoked about that because I don't like to fly.
Yeah.
So it's like a 6-hour drive south for me. We're holding a press panel. We're addressing local independent media and local organizers and activists kind of broadly about why this should matter to them. And then specifically why, as members of the media or activists, they should be concerned about this. Because really, Julian Assange is just the head on the stake. And yes, it is brutal that, you know, a guy with Asperger's who's a nonviolent to the, like, wouldn't hurt a bird about it, is being tortured. That's brutal. It is. It's brutal that his civil liberties have been violated, his human rights have been violated, and his legal rights have been trampled on. The United States there was a direct line, Deborah, a live feed from the Ecuadorian embassy where not just Julian's living room, but his bedroom and the women's bathroom down the hall in the Ecuadorian embassy, live stream to the CIA, because Julian Assange may have a meeting in the bathroom, because who would bug the women's bathroom in the Ecuadorian embassy? Well, now we know the CIA does, because the guy who was running security for the Ecuadorian embassy, a guy named David Morales, he's going to prison for his role in helping the CIA violate Julian Assange's legal rights.
Ecuador,
but he's going to prison in Spain.
Okay.
Where he lives. And it's a Spanish security firm called UC Global that got hired to do security for the Ecuadorian embassy. The CIA came in right after they got Lenin Moreno elected in 2017 in Ecuador and said, "Hey, we don't want you to stop doing security. We just want you to take another check. Like to increase your revenue stream, right? Okay. Well, just, you know, stick these bugs here. Have it sent to this server address." The CIA set up their own, like, servers to handle the live stream from the Ecuadorian embassy so that they could analyze it in real time. And we're focused on his meetings with his attorneys. Now, there is no way you can paint around that's a breach of lawyer-client confidentiality. That's the basic tenet upon which all Western jurisprudence lays.
It seems so weird that he wouldn't. I mean, isn't, like, the Ecuadorian embassy in what country?
In London.
Okay. In London.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be considered Ecuadorian? It's not Ecuadorian.
It's Ecuadorian soil inside. Yeah. Once you step onto the property, you are on Ecuadorian soil. You are, but the government of Ecuador, without any due process or telling Julian Assange, revoked his citizenship.
Okay. And that was when you saw him getting, like, dragged out, looking like a crazy guy with the long hair and stuff. Yeah. And they had said that he was, like, smearing shit on the walls and stuff like that.
Yeah.
To make it seem like, oh, we needed to get him out of there to get him, like, a mental facility or something.
Yeah. And they had to retract that claim because Julian's legal team said, well, you have 24-hour real-time video footage of everything that went on in the embassy. Release it. And they went, we can't do that. Then everybody would know we were illegally spying on him. We'll just retract the claim. And so then, they quietly retracted that.
And so they never got it. They got nothing ever came out of that footage. They didn't get anything from it. It was just there. Maybe they got Pamela Anderson naked on it, or
everybody that went and visited him had to submit their phones and laptops and stuff like that. Like they got everybody's data that got anywhere near Julian Assange in that embassy. But what they wanted was to, you know, make sure that he wouldn't, they wanted to know what his argument in court was going to be. They wanted to know what they had to prepare for, to get around for. They just competitive edge in a courtroom because they knew it was going to go to trial. You know, or when you know that your case is built on a house of lies, you need to cheat to win. And so that's what they're doing.
Yeah.
I don't have a different way to frame it, really.
So you're going to L.A., on the 11th, and what's going to happen there?
So we're going to meet at CBS Columbia Square. We're going to be joined by a number of different organizations. We'll probably talk a little bit. We're going to march a block up to Hollywood Boulevard. We're going to march down Hollywood Boulevard, and then land at the CNN. We're going to on Sunset Boulevard and Kahinga, which is like a block down. And there will be many people forming a line to talk to CNN about the way that they particularly not just covered this case, but we would like to talk to them about employing more members of the national security state than any other news outlet on the planet, which is, I don't know if you guys knew this or not, but yeah, like more former spies work for CNN than any other news outlet, which is something that wouldn't be possible were it not for the 2012 National Defense Authorization Act, which gave us the Smith-Mundt Modernization Act.
Deborah, yeah. Do you remember what Smith-Mundt Modernization is?
No.
We talked about it before.
Remind me.
So Smith-Mundt Act was the act, do you know when the original one was implemented, Steve? Sometime in the 40s or something like that?
It was 41.
Okay, it said it's so
the World War, it came out of World War, of World War.
It was like a pushback against like what was going on probably in Nazi Germany. It says that the media and government, I don't know the exact wording, but it says that the media can't, or the government can't propagandize
its own citizens.
Okay.
Citizens. You can't have members of the military come on to tell you, you know, that the military is good and right and justified in what it's doing.
So in 2012, your best friend, Black Jesus, Barack Obama, implements the Smith-Mundt Modernization Act. And it's, you know, it's modernizing it. It's got to make it better. But all that the modernization did was repeal it.
So and it cut out the middleman.
So it's legal to propagandize. Is it for the media or for the government or both?
Well, it's so under the original Smith-Mundt, the government couldn't use the media as a vehicle for propaganda.
Got it.
And now, not only is the government encouraged to do so, but media companies are incentivized by advertiser support to bring on former high-ranking government officials because it helps them. You know, like if your main advertisers are Boeing, Lockheed, Raytheon, and Shell, you want
Pfizer, Moderna.
Yeah, you want a former Secretary of Defense. You want Michael Hayden out there. You want, you know, Brennan or Clapper or whoever. You want those guys on your show because they're going to make you money. In fact, some of them might even be on your board, you know. It's just in a lot of cases, the money never leaves the room. It can travel around the world, but it doesn't really leave the room. You've got the same people there's a revolving door. I mean, have you guys talked about the revolving door of lobbyists and defense and weapons contractors in DC? How like every administration says, we're going to close the door on lobbying. And then they open it a little bit wider.
Yeah.
But yeah, because it's a revolving door, because you can go straight from being Speaker of the House to a 9-figure-a-year lobbying job that will then land you a spot at a defense contractor on their board that will then put you on CNN. And like, it's just, it keeps going. And the whole time, we get less and less and less. We're expected to do more and more and more. And all of the wars keep going. They keep getting added. And the attacks on, you know, being able to walk out your door and tell your neighbor what's going on. Like, yeah, that is now being frowned upon, told that you shouldn't do that.
We're all the same. The same thing's happening with Big Pharma as well.
100%. Yeah. I mean, look, I don't know about you guys. There's a conversation going on about like whether or not the police should have qualified immunity, which means police should be unaccountable for anything that they do. And broadly, most people disagree with that. No, the police should not have qualified immunity. Well, if you can agree with that, you should be able to agree with the fact that vaccine companies should not have qualified immunity too. Yet they do.
Yeah.
And have for decades now.
Since 86 or whatever, when Reagan signed that in, because they said if we have to pay for our fuck ups, we're just not going to produce vaccines anymore. And they couldn't have that.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the things that I'm a huge proponent of is informed consent. I'm a huge fan of informed consent. And that's something that we find very little of where Big Pharma is concerned.
Yeah. Got it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so- I don't, you know, like I'm not trying to like say, you know, I've talked to a lot of journalists about this, talked to a lot of people in the medical profession about this, I think it's really important to approach any organization with qualified immunity skeptically.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a good solution. I mean, I got some pretty weird ideas. I'm an anarcho-capitalist. So, but if we're going to keep, you know, publicly funded police forces, they could do something like make them carry their own insurance or something like that. I think that would, where they could be sued.
Spend a little bit more time not actively recruiting PTSD as fuck soldiers.
Yeah.
You could spend a little bit more time on de-escalation. You could not say, all right, man, you spent 130 hours at the range. Here's your badge. Get out there and be the law.
Yeah. As I tell people all the time, I'm an elevator mechanic. It took me, you know, 6 years as an apprentice to become a mechanic. Yeah. You know,
like, hairdressers have to spend more hours in school than police officers do.
Yeah. So... Well, what would happen if they, let's do a little segue here. Watch this. What would happen if police officers maybe started microdosing psilocybin?
We would probably have a lot less officer involved shootings.
Yeah. Do you want to get into that at all?
I would love to. I would. And this is another thing. Like, I always like to know where people's baselines are. So have you ever taken psychedelics, Deborah?
Yes. And I have taken psilocybin.
Have you read up on like microdose studies or
not really? I know that there are different drugs that are on the list that are being used in a microdose for psychological and depression and stuff of that nature.
I am I'm pretty fortunate where I live, even though I hate where I live and I can't wait to leave California. I can't. Oh my God. I can't. I never thought I'd say that either.
Where are you going?
I really Eastern Tennessee.
Yeah.
Yeah. is where I think that's probably the best spot for,
you know, who Nicole Sauce is, Living Free in Tennessee podcast.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I think we're getting her on in a couple of weeks, but yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. No, she's great. But yeah, I've got family from a little town called Sparta, Tennessee. And I grew up in central Indiana and, you know, friends all in the area, but just in terms of like seasonal growing and natural water running through property and availability of acreage, that's it. I mean, it meets all of my personal requirements for where I want to have land.
Yeah. But keep going on the microdosing. Sorry.
So here though, in Santa Cruz County, in Santa Cruz, there's a place called MAPS. It's the Multidisciplinary Academy for Psychedelic Research. Mm-hmm. Psychedelic Studies. Sorry, MAPS. And they're the people that have been for the last several years commissioning and putting out all of these studies and this research on not just psilocybin, but like MDMA. And things like anxiety, depression, PTSD, and what they found unequivocally, no matter who runs the study or what the control group looks like, is that small amounts of psilocybin or MDMA greatly improve your depression, anxiety, and PTSD. There's kind of a, I don't know. It breaks the programming and parameters that you have about, you know, the conventions about what you're dealing with. Because if you're anxious, if you're depressed, if you've got PTSD, then you're stigmatizing yourself because now you're different. Something's wrong with you. You know, there's something wrong with your mind, and as an individual, any human being has a hard time wrapping their head around that, you know, and has a hard time processing and dealing with the fact that societally now something is wrong with them. They are less or different or other, and the psilocybin breaks all of those barriers because you don't care. You don't now, like it's what has been, I guess, shoved onto you as what reality is. Those conventions don't exist anymore. And it's not like microdosing isn't, it's not like tripping. You're not high. It's just the things that were bothering you don't come into play anymore, because that's not, reality has shifted just enough to where now your field of vision is a little bit clearer, colors are a little bit more vibrant, your ability to breathe in and out has improved, and it's when you can breathe better, you're not as stressed, your body isn't as pinched. And a lot of that has to do with the kind of pressure and anxiety that you're putting on yourself. So when you're not concentrating on that, when that's not at the forefront of your consciousness, you're breathing better. And then you're a lot more relaxed and you're able to take in and process everything that comes your way throughout the day a lot better. I have no idea if I make any sense.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. I think, you know, being able to worry about something that's important is still necessary, but maybe the microdosing can get rid of all the other bullshit that's like not allowing you to concentrate on something that seems impossible to do because there's so much other stuff messing with your mind. Does that sound, something's right, you know? Because I know when I'm having trouble, I have like a general sense of impending doom, and it makes, you know, normal daily tasks seem like you can't, they're impossible.
Yeah. I mean, I personally, I believe that like each and every one of us are subjected to multiple traumas from the moment that we're born. A lot of that have to do with like societal conventions and propaganda. But we're also told that like, you know, you have to be a certain way when you're in front of certain people, most of us are, from like the time that we're born, you know, and that you can only have certain types of conversations in front of certain types of people. And it creates a sort of almost schizophrenia in everyone, because you don't know who you're supposed to be growing up, really. And then you've got people telling you, you know, like what they would like you to be, or what you should become, or what you're supposed to be based on what a relative did. And there's a real, like, I understand why people have identity dysphoria. I do. I get it. We're assaulted by all kinds of different conceptions through, you know, our culture and our media and all of that. I mean, it's maddening. It really is. So that sense of impending doom, or that sense of not being able to move because, you know, like everything's too much in the moment. I feel like that's been weaponized, and I feel like small amounts of psilocybin or small amounts of MDMA might be a way to, I don't know, fight back against that weaponization. Because when you've got people confused or scared or doubting themselves, or, you know, or like fear, you know, just expecting the worst, then you can control them. You can manipulate those people if you're relaxed, if you're comfortable with yourself, if you're, you know, generally like okay with your surroundings and you're breathing right and you're centered, you can't be manipulated as easy.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, like, you know, I talked to you a little bit over Telegram, and I just said, you know, I've been sober for a long time. I took some mushrooms a little bit ago. It was like the first time I'd done anything in like almost 9 years. Mm-hmm. I'm still sober. But, you know, it's like I'm not anymore, but if I was still active in 12-step programs, you know, most people in there's some that wouldn't, but most people in there would say like, that's a no-no, you know, you can't.
Yeah.
You can't do that. If someone has some interest in looking into this to help themselves, what is a safe way to get started in the process?
I mean, it's kind of hard to tell individual potency out of a bag of mushrooms. Right.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to figure out.
So what I will do is weigh out a gram and then crush it and, you know, to basically reduce it to powder because it tastes like crap anyway. And then section it out into like, you know, 5 semi-equal looking portions, and that's my Monday through Friday.
Yeah, you just do one, you split a gram over a whole week with like a pill a day.
Yeah. And I've got like lion's mane mushrooms, which are supposed to help with just your thought processes and stuff. Like fungus does incredible stuff in general. Mushrooms, like all of them, whether they're psychedelic or not, they're almost alien in terms of like the benefits that they get from you. A guy named Paul Stamets.
Yeah.
Yeah. Does wonderfuls on like non-psychedelic mushrooms. He does great, great research and work on that. So I'll do that in like a little bit of kratom, and I'll put it in a pill form. And then that's my vitamin for the day, basically.
Got it. And, what does the kratom, kratom, whatever people, I heard it's supposed to be called kratom. Does that kind of give you a caffeine effect?
No, because I don't do the green leaf. I do the red leaf because personally I use kratom for chronic pain. I used to be a roofer.
Okay.
And, I fell 18 feet off the roof and landed on my feet on the sidewalk. And effectively ended my roofing career. Although I still work in carpentry and construction now too. I just spend a lot less time on a roof. But I wasn't patched back up all the way right. And so I've been in a lot of pain for like 15 years. And I don't like I don't like pharmaceutical heroin. I don't like opioids. I don't like any of that. Kratom actually like cancels out opioids. It plays with your opioid receptors without it being an opioid. It's kind of, and then like if you, because I'm crazy enough to try. So somebody gave me a 5 milligram morphine pill after I'd been taking Kratom regularly for a few months, and I took it and it did nothing, like absolutely nothing. I didn't feel anything. The opioid receptors were blocked.
Yeah. So that's
what is Kratom?
It is a like Southeast Asian plant.
Deborah, if you saw, if you drive past liquor stores, head shops, you'll see signs for it now that you know what it is. Spelled Kratom.
Okay. And it's a plant?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's almost looks like a rhododendron without the flowers.
So, So Deborah, it's supposed to, people have been using it to, you know, get rid of the cravings for opiates, heroin addiction, pills, all sorts of stuff like that.
And alcohol, I've heard too.
Yeah. Yeah. Alcohol as well. And the FDA has basically waged war on it.
Of course.
Why would they do that?
They try to ban it every year, and Kratom advocates like come through like no other and have been able to effectively stave it off. It itself isn't addictive. I've heard people say that like when they quit it, it messed them up for a couple of days. And then they were okay. I've stopped taking because again, I'm in recovery. I consider myself sober. I haven't drank in nearly 5 years. That was the problem that I had.
Yeah.
It doesn't even sound fun to me anymore. It really doesn't. I've heard like it effectively, I didn't try it to quit drinking. I had I was having severe body pains, and a friend of mine was like, oh, you should try this. I've been taking it for a number of years. It helps me with my pain. And that's how I got introduced to it. And it's been as pain management, it's been as effective as anything that I've tried. The way that I kind of describe it is when like an ibuprofen isn't cutting it, but you don't want to go for anything like harder.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like that's the lane for, you know, that's when I'll go for it.
Yeah.
Is it similar to like a nerve block kind of?
No. There's a Hamilton's Pharmacopoeia on it that I would recommend you guys watch.
Have you watched that show, Deborah?
No.
It's so awesome. It's on for free on Hulu or Amazon, I think.
And I think you could YouTube the Kratom episode.
Okay.
I think you can, but he did a really good, that was a really good episode. And that was what was recommended to me when my friend suggested I try it a number of years ago, because I did. I was like, well, I've got some questions. And he was like, well, here, check this out. And, and I used that as a baseline. I did a little bit more research, made a decision, and I'm comfortable with the decision still.
Yeah.
I think that's about the best we can all do. Really.
I might go watch that today. I love that guy. He was on Tinfoil Hat recently. It was a really good episode.
I just did Zero.
Cool.
Sam's spiritual show.
Yeah, we're gonna go on with him, the guys from Truthzilla, and Sean Dustin from Nowhere to Go But Up.
Nice.
Next Thursday or next Sunday, we're gonna all go on together and do a little hour long show. And then we get to go on.
Fun.
And then we get to go on with Lindsay from Rogueways, who's like my favorite person in the world. She's
Lindsay's
awesome.
Rad, man. Yeah, she is. So great. I've known her for a number of years now.
Yeah,
she was at my house a couple of 2019 now, but yeah, for hanging out for my kid's 7th birthday, I like built out a bed and sleeping unit in her van. And
oh, cool.
Yeah, she's a buddy.
Yeah.
if you have any other questions, I'm happy to address them. I don't...
I'm good. What do you think, Deborah?
I can't wait to go watch this Hamilton Pharmacopoeia episodes, but yeah, it's really been very eye-opening. Thank you to learn all this other stuff around Julian Assange. And
yeah, I'm so glad we got to do it. I'm glad we got to meet up with you, Steve. Yeah, keep me posted on some cool places to go. And for some, I feel some weird attraction to like Kentucky or Tennessee or like Northern Georgia or like West Virginia or something like that. I know it's going to be hard. It's going to be hard to get the other half to agree to that, but we're selling our house, I think, in a couple months. So, I mean, we fled San Francisco and accidentally went to Portland. So, you know, it's not, I love everything about Oregon except for Portland, you know?
Yeah, no,
it's a beautiful, and I mean, you're in the Santa Cruz Mountains. How can you go wrong with that? My buddy just finally got out of Oakland and got there. So it's better for him too. But
the cover charge for this zip code is ridiculous though, man. It is. And like, I lived up by Mount Hood 20 years ago and I loved it, but I wouldn't go back now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. If it weren't for Portland, it would be okay. But you know, why don't you tell everybody where they can find you, where they can support you, how they can get involved?
So action4assange.com. That's the website. It's got all of our events. It's got like full schedule. Slownewsdayshow.com is my website. Full archive of the show. And I think a full archive of all of the free Assange vigils that we've done. I also have been co-hosting Anonymous Bites Back.
These all in podcast form too, or just on the website?
They're all in podcast and video form, multiple platforms. I've been recommending that you watch Slow News Day and all of the other stuff on the Rockfin. YouTube has been horrible to us.
Yeah, we just got our first strike.
I got my video blocked, my live stream from this morning blocked because we showed some of a Saturday Night Live clip and I didn't even monetize the video.
Yeah.
I didn't have monetization set on it. And they were like, yeah, no, you can't do that. So anonymousworldwide.com with all of the podcast episodes for ABB and plus a ton of articles. And let's see.
You're on Union of the Unwanted usually every week, right?
I try to make it. Yeah. The Union of the Unwanteds have been just wonderful, man. Those have been such a blessing over the last couple of months. It's such a great idea those guys had. Really glad that they were putting that together. Yeah. Big shout out to Sam and Charlie and Ricky. That is, man. Good idea, fellas, all around.
Yeah. Well, let's let you get back to your Sunday. This has been really awesome. Thanks so much for doing it. And stay in contact when you get some more news on what's going on with you. Let us know in Open Door Policy. So,
yeah, absolutely. And I would love to have you guys on Slow News Day, too. It'd
be awesome. We would love to be on. Everybody always says that and never calls us. So please.
Oh, no, I follow through. I do.
Okay. Got it. Yeah. All right, thank guys.
You. Thanks very much.
Thanks again to Steve. And we will get this out midweek sometime. And we will see y'all soon. We got an insane lineup coming up. Support Steve. Pray for Deborah. We love you all. Bye, guys.
Bye.